Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. Inspiring stories that change lives. Where ordinary heroes tell their extraordinary stories of how they have triumphed over unexpected challenges. This is where we say what can't be said and use the AAA formula for freedom. Awareness, acceptance, and action. Now, here's your host, Hillary Burns.
Well, welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And today I have some very exciting news. I have a new sponsor, and the new sponsor is Kikori App. Kikori makes corporate team building and school social emotional learning fun. Help your teams or students create community and connection with social emotional learning. That is not just one more thing on your plate, but that is fun for you and your students and corporate teams. Visit KikoriApp.com for more information. And I happen to know personally, this is an amazing company. My daughter works for them. She's the, the director of, some design. She designs the app, and it's beautiful, and the people are amazing. And when they do these activities, your life does get more connected, more fun, and just alters your life. So I invite you to visit KikoriApp.com to get more information. Now, today I am here with a very special guest, award-winning Erica Hayasaki. And Erica, well, we're gonna get into it. There's a lot I could say about Erica, but we're gonna just kind of launch into the dialogue, and you're gonna hear what she's been up to and the book that she's written. Well, I can tell you about that because I do have it. It's called Somewhere Sisters. And I'll tell you what, I read it on the way to, oops, I can't show it because I forgot to click my green screen. All right, let me fix that. And, but anyway, hold on a second. I want you to be able to see it. There we go. Okay, so Somewhere Sisters, a story of adoption, identity, and the meaning of family, which is such a fascinating story. I can't wait to talk about it with Erica. And welcome, Erica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You got your coffee? You're all set?
Almost.
Oh, no. All right. Well, we've had some excitement getting on today, but we're here now. And, I can't wait to hear about you're all right. You need to get it, or you want to?
I'll get it.
It's being brought to you.
I have some drink and some water.
Okay. All right. If you need to run and get it, I can talk. But
We're good.
Okay. All right. Cool. All right. So, Erica, tell me about first. I want to hear about you, and then we'll talk about the book. How did you get started? I mean, obviously, you're a journalist. What was your childhood like that you ended up being a journalist? Because most people want to be and they don't end up doing it. So how did you make that happen?
That's a good question. Well, I was born in Champaign, Illinois, and that's a small college town. And I was raised in the Midwest for part of my life, and it was a good place to grow up. But also there were times when I encountered some racism being Asian American. So I think that sort of led me to start writing. And I know that started to be me writing when I was younger. And then I ended up getting into journalism. Even in high school, I moved to the Seattle area, ended up moving and getting into high school there. And I also went into journalism through some internships and Seattle Times program, majored in journalism. It went back to the University of Illinois, majored in journalism. And then I ended up at the LA Times when I was like 21.
Wow.
I was writing for the LA Times for a good 9 years. I was a national correspondent for the LA Times based in New York. And I wrote a book at that point in my life. It's called The Death Class, and I spent several years shadowing a professor and her students in New Jersey. She's a professor who studies death, and she would teach her classes in the middle of cemeteries or take her students to prison and have them talk to people on death row. And, you know,
what was it called? The death what?
The death class.
What's yeah. the class?
It's called the death class. And it's normal.
What's the second word?
The death class. CLASS. So it's a class.
Oh, class. Okay.
Yeah, it's a university class.
Oh, okay. I was like, clap. I couldn't figure out what. Okay. All right. So the death class. So that whole class was on death. That's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. And spent time with her writing a book with her and about she's in the main character. And then there's different students in the book. And I took the class. And that was that came out in 2014. And then now I teach journalism at UC Irvine, literary journalism program, and I write for magazines. So I started a freelance, you know, magazine writing career, and I write for the New York Times Magazine and Wired and Atlantic and other places like that. So mostly feature stories. So that's how I became a journalist. And now I have written a second book.
Yeah. So just going back, was it hard to get that first job at the LA Times when you were 21?
It was through an internship program. So
okay.
It was hard. Yeah, it was very competitive. It was an internship program for people ranging from out of college to mid-career, and very competitive, and they flew us all out there, and we ended up, some of us got into the program and some did not, but it was a lot of work. It was breaking news, mm-hmm. and doing a lot of pretty intense kind of reporting, a lot of reporting around traumatic events, you know, that's sort of what led me to the book, because, you know, I had to do a lot of reporting on, you know, plane crashes, shootings, train crashes, you know, all kinds of things.
Wow. So the first book, you mean, The Death Class?
Yeah, The Death
Class. Yeah. Wow, that's a whole another topic, right? So, okay, so you've had this crazy career. Now, did you go traveling all over the place? If there was a plane crash, were you one of the people that would fly there and be there?
Yeah, I was. I guess one of the major stories that I covered at that time was the shootings at Virginia Tech University. One I remember quite vividly. I do write about it in the book because I ended up, you know, the shootings were happening and I got on a plane that day and had to fly into Virginia and spend a couple weeks in Virginia interviewing, you know, family members and teachers and people who'd survived. And it was really tough, you know, that was unfortunately one of the mass shootings in a college campus. One of the biggest ones, but unfortunately there have been so many more since, you know. But, you know, those type of situations take a toll on you as a journalist, I think, when you're writing about trauma so deeply and right in the aftermath of it. And certainly it's hard for, you know, for families, and some of them talk to you, some of them don't want to, but that's sort of the job that I was doing for a long time. And then I decided to leave and try journalism. I mean, sorry, try teaching journalism and writing, freelancing and things like that. Because the breaking news part of it is, it's a lot of work. It's hard and demanding, and it's also emotionally taxing.
So was writing The Death Class, did it help you like release some of it or get through some of it or heal some of that or
oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because the professor, her name is Norma Bow. I still talk to her today. She still does the class. She's an incredible professor, and she told me that if I wanted to write about her, I would need to take the class myself. And so I did. And you know, one of my first encounters with death was the murder of my 16-year-old friend when I was in high school, which is something I ended up also writing about.
Wow.
It was by her abusive boyfriend on the day of the Oklahoma City bombing. And that was something that I ended up processing through years later through the taking this one, you know, this professor's class. And it was just the way that she ended up kind of exposing her students to different aspects of death to make it less scary, to make us understand, you know, it sounds like we should know that life is precious and, you know, just to sort of pay attention to the moments. But that was really how the whole class was designed to to take some of the fear away and whatever other emotions that, you know, you might have around death and just confront it or live with it, sit with it, and also enjoy, you know, life.
Yeah.
It was, for me, a life-changing experience for sure. And not that I, you know, have, not like you'll ever overcome these fears of death or anxieties, but certainly it's helped me to think about it in a different way.
And what school was she teaching that at?
She teaches at Kane University in New Jersey.
Okay. Wow. That's really interesting. Yeah, my aunt just passed away and my mom has dementia and, you know, it's just kind of there, like.
Yeah.
I mean, if I, you know, my sister and I were talking, my mom, you know, my sister had been at my mom's house and she left and my mom called her and she's like, oh, where are you going? Like, she had no recollection that she was there. She had just left. And my sister and I were just like, wow. Like, if that was me, I would be freaking out. But my mom is just happy and fun and living today. You know, like, she's not in a fear mode. And
yeah,
she's 92. So it's just, it's so interesting to look at that. I mean, it's a disease. It's like cancer, but it's different and it just affects someone differently. But
yeah,
you know, it's always there. Like, is that going to be me? Well, how will I be? You know, and it's like, no, stay here now. We're not there. Let that go. Yeah. You know, but it's always, you know, your thoughts kind of go crazy. So
yeah. And I guess a couple of themes that run through my work, also one of the big ones is identity. And so I've written about people who've had different forms of dementia or who've had the loss of, like, they don't have the ability to have certain memories at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the questions that arise for me, you know, are often around the quality of a life or what makes you who you are if you don't have your memories or access to certain parts of yourself, or if that changes, and what people think about, you know, might think about you or how you might view yourself. So I've, you know, that's something that I think a lot about these hard issues, I guess. And
yeah.
Mental health. And those are some that also, I thank you for sharing that about your family as well.
Yeah. And where do you write about that? Is that another book or are those just your articles?
I've written for piece. I wrote a piece for Wired, which was a piece about a woman, Susie McKinnon is her name. And she has no access to her episodic memory. So that means the scenes of your life. And so I profiled her. She has the access of her semantic memory, which is like sort of the Wikipedia page version of her life. And she knows the details and facts, but can't remember the scenes of her life. So I was interested in what that was like. And I wrote a profile of her for Wired. And then I wrote another piece about, it was for California Sunday Magazine. And it was a piece about a man named Joel Dreyer. He was living his life, had a, you know, a very successful life as a psychiatrist and married and had children, and suddenly, you know, his personality began to change dramatically. He started selling drugs, left his wife, you know, got arrested. He became a known drug dealer in California. And he gets arrested and ends up in prison, which is where I met him. And I also interviewed members of his family. But what happened I interviewed him when he was in prison, and I also looked at his records. They realized during the course of his trial that he had developed something called frontotemporal dementia, which is a kind of dementia that impacts the prefrontal cortex and of your brain, which is the where, you know, some of your kind of moral decision making can, you know, be affected if you're if you have this particular dementia, or sort of your filter, I guess, for shame or for maybe stepping over the line into committing a crime. And I there are studies around that that I was able to pull and talk to researchers. And so it became, it's not just a story about a man who ended up selling drugs. Clearly,
right.
I was talking about what happens when your personality so dramatically changes and impacts the lives of everybody around you to this extent. So those are just a couple of examples. I've written others as well.
Wow. Have you heard of a guy? I heard him on a podcast, Daniel Amen. I think that's how you say it. He's got a company called Brain MD.
And you know, he might have been in somebody that I think I've researched a little bit.
Yeah. Because he says, you know, some of the kids that are acting strange and stuff, if they go back, they've either had a, you know, an injury or a traumatic event that can do that, that can totally alter their behavior. So you wonder if that's what caused that dementia. You know, yeah, I just wonder because that's what.
Well, no, it's the same kind of thing. I wonder because when I did the story about Joel Dreyer and his story, I ended up coming across a research study about inmates in a Colorado jail. And psychologists had studied all of these inmates that were in this jail. They were allowed into the jail to study their brains. They were not just psychologists, but neurologists. And so I ended up writing a piece for Newsweek on that and going to the prison, to the jail, interviewing not only the inmates, but the researchers, because they found an extraordinarily high number of the people who had been arrested and put into this facility had traumatic brain injuries at some point in their life. So they were not only studying their brains, but their psych, you know, their life stories about various brain injuries that they had had. And at one point, the number was, I think it was as high as 90%, but I think that became lower as the research went on, but still well over 50%. And so that, of course, raises questions that are important for the courts too. You know,
yeah.
Yeah, a big, huge question that society has to kind of grapple with and think about.
Yeah, these aren't just like bad people. You know, someone, this is off topic, but I was listening to someone say that children always have good intentions. They're never trying to be bad, you know, but it's like, you know, bad kid. No, they're not. You know, they have a reason for doing what they do. So people aren't inherently bad, but with getting hit on the head, like, boom, all of a sudden, you know, that's like a flag, I would say, for a parent or someone to say, hey, did something happen? Your behavior's changed, instead of they're just a bad kid, you know? Anyway,
yeah.
I find it interesting, you know?
And of course, there's been a lot of research around football and, traumatic brain injuries, and they've learned a lot from that too, and also who, you know, or various athletes or even veterans who, you know, whose personalities have changed dramatically.
Yeah, it's so interesting, right?
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I've been taking you off the topic of your current book. Somewhere Sisters, I'll hold it up again now that I have my green screen. You know, are you ready to talk about this? Is there anything else you want to tell us before you get into it? I know you had twins yourself.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had twins about 6 years ago now. And that led me to, well, as you can see, I write about a lot of different topics and whatever sort of interesting to me. In my life at the moment. So, you know, and so one of the questions that I've always been interested, like I said earlier, I've always been interested in identity and certainly nature and nurture, and twins, the study of twins has a long history of research with identity and nature versus nurture. And so I ended up connecting to a twin researcher in California. And she, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic about twins. And I wrote particularly about epigenetics. Epigenetics is the study of, actually one of my twins just walked in.
Oh, let's see.
he's going over to see us. That's okay.
I think when you come forward, we can see you better. Somehow when you go back, you get more dark. So
sorry about that.
No. I'm just taking a break to tell you that so that people can see you. So epigenetics, is that the word?
Yeah, epigenetics. So essentially what I was interested in when I was studying epigenetics and writing about it was the interplay between genes and the environment. So how much your environment might impact your genes. And there's a whole field of research around that. And that was what I was looking at. But anyways, I met different twin researchers and twin pairs, because that was part of what I was writing about for The Atlantic. And then this one particular twin pair stood out to me. They were born in Vietnam and separated at birth. And one was raised by a family in America and the other by a family in Vietnam, a biological aunt. Their birth mother could not care for them. She did not have the means to care for them, so took one of them to an orphanage. And then the other one was too sick to go into the orphanage, so she ended up being raised by her biological aunt and her aunt's partner in Vietnam. And they did not know much about each other at all. And really, they knew a little bit about each other, but nothing for many years until they one day did, and they were reunited. So I wanted to tell that story.
Did the and it's a great book. I recommend it. But did they? I know that the twins didn't. It, or at least what I gathered from the book, the twins didn't know about each other until they were older. But did the aunt? Did the aunt must have known, because she was related to the mother, right? The
one. Yeah, I mean, raising, they all. The twin in Vietnam did know, because when she was four. Her moms who raised her, her biological aunt and her aunt's partner, put her on a motorbike and drove her to the orphanage. And they said she was going to meet her twin sister.
Oh.
But then by the time they got there, she learned that the sister had been adopted.
Okay.
So never got to meet her at that point. And then the other twin, she... eventually heard about having a twin, but didn't really think much of it. She didn't go set off on her own as a kid to find the twin. She just lived her life.
Right.
And then they ended up being reunited as teenagers.
Yeah. I mean, it was so interesting. Again, the book is fascinating. I don't mean to tell about, give the book away, but you know, that their backgrounds were so different. You know, one was raised in America, going to school in college, or whatever, like an American. And the other was in the fields, dealing with the weather and the floods and, such a different life, that when they did meet it, you would have thought they would just embrace and all that, but it was very different than that. That was very interesting. I can't imagine, I can't imagine what it would have been like, but I mean, you talked to them, right? I mean.
Yeah. I mean, that's another, I couldn't imagine how that would have been, dramatically different lives. One was raised Buddhist. The other was raised Catholic. One spoke Vietnamese. The other spoke English. One lived in a village, with storms that came through and sometimes wiped out the village home. Had sporadic access to electricity. Went to, it didn't have toys. She talked about playing with like the dust and playing with building a swing set under the moon and swinging on the trees. And she didn't have store-bought toys. They would create her own things to play with, and loved her life in Vietnam in this village. And even though it was a simple life, it was something that she really loved. The other twin was adopted with another, adopted with another child from the orphanage. So they were not biologically related, but they were sort of raised as twins because they were dressed, you know, their mom would dress them alike and all of this. And they were close in the orphanage and became adopted to the U.S. together. But like I said, they grew up in a big family. So the twin in Vietnam grew up as an only child, but the twin who was raised in America grew up in a large family, lots of siblings, including the one that was adopted with her, went to Catholic schools. Their family had a lot of money and did well for themselves, you know, and so she had access to, you know, privileges of a young person who has access to resources in the U.S. And grew up in they're Asian American, obviously, and grew up in a mostly white, predominantly white neighborhood, in a suburb of Chicago. So she was, you know, that was something that she talked about in the book. Whereas the sister in Vietnam grew up with everybody who was Vietnamese. However, the mothers who adopted her, in Vietnam, her biological aunt, her aunt's partner, part of a same-sex marriage. So that was a source, you know, that was part of some bullying that did happen when she was growing up, you know, in Vietnam. So there are different issues that they talked about throughout the book,
mm-hmm.
Around their lives, ups and downs, like joys and hardships, and also just how different their experiences were. And certainly when I thought about them reuniting, I also thought of the kind of reunions that maybe you'd see on TV of a twin reunion or people who've long lost family. But this one was actually quite different. And it was more complicated and uncomfortable. They were 13. It's a lot happening and a lot of people involved. And so, but I appreciated that it's not just some sort of made for TV fairy tale that you might see. It was very real and had a lot of human emotions, and whether that was pain or they do eventually connect with each other, but it doesn't happen instantaneously.
And when were you writing this? Before, like after it all happened, or during it?
This was all after. I used a technique called narrative reconstruction, and that is when the journalist is not there for the event, like,
right,
so they rely on interviews, records, photos, videos, interviews with people around them to reconstruct the events, and to just walk somebody through their lives and tell the story in detail, and you know, you might read it and it feels like it's a scene, you know, that feels like you were there, or quite vivid, like it's,
yeah,
vivid, but it's not, because it's been all reported through interviews or different archives and records.
Wow, cool. All right.
So I came in when they were already like 18 and had been reunited at 13.
Okay.
And now they're in their mid 20s. So, it was a process of like, just having people tell me the story. I did travel to Vietnam with them, and I interviewed their birth mother. I interviewed the mothers who raised the twin in Vietnam. I interviewed various family members. I met their living fourth grandmother. I did that and went to the orphanage and went to the village where one of the twins grew up, lived her life. So that's a part of reconstruction, because, you know, you can visit the places to understand and write about it.
Yeah. Cool. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back, and I want to find out what you learned about all of that.
Okay.
So let's go to the commercial.
Thanks.
Are you inspired? Are you living a life story you are proud to tell? Are you actively pursuing and creating the life of your dreams? Well, if not, you really need Hillary's AAA program for freedom. Just visit gettingrealwithhillary.com and schedule a time with Hillary today.
And once again, just to remind you, our new sponsor is Kikori App. Go to kikoriapp.com if you want more information on social emotional learning and how we can transform the lives of our children. So welcome back, Erica. So I know you were studying, we're talking about your book. Let me hold it up again, Somewhere Sisters. So what did you, you could talk more about the book if you want. It's fascinating, but I would like to know, like, what did you learn about the difference? You know, how much did genetics, what is it, environment versus genetics? Or, you know, what did you learn about that?
I mean, I think that what I have come to understand is that throughout history, there have been these sharp swings toward genes are a matter, genes matter above all else in shaping who we are. And we've seen that kind of science pushed in history. Mm-hmm. And then toward the other side, behaviorism, you know, there have been researchers throughout history who've said that it really is only comes down to where you are raised and who raises you in your environment. And give me a child and I can turn that child into whomever I want them to be, right? And so there's these two sharp swings back and forth, back and forth. Is it nature? Is it nurture? Is it nature or is it nurture? And what I've come to understand through the research and through my own life with twins and through these twins that I wrote about is that, you know, there is a very complex interplay that happens between your genes and the environment. That's the area of epigenetics that I was mentioning before, but also, you know, there's random chance that happens. So even if you have twins with identical genes, there could be mutations, there could be certain genetic effects that flip on, the environmental effects could flip on a particular gene for one twin and not the other. And so even though they might have identical genes, which is what identical twins have, there are these differences. And even if you're, like I'm raising my own twins, they're six now, but they're so very clearly different in so many ways. And
are they identical too?
Are, yeah. Okay. But they've been living in the same home for their whole lives. They have not been separated, but even within a home, they have some non-shared environments, which is what scientists call them. So even within the home, you might have differences in how you're raised, or one might, you know, have a different experience with a friend or a different experience with a book, or all these little things. One might get in trouble, the other doesn't, you know, and so what happens after that, you know, these little experiences in their lives could change, could shape them differently. So obviously they're not clones and they're not exactly alike. And in fact, they're quite different. Now, if you have the twins who've been raised worlds apart, different languages, different lifestyles completely, they're going to have obvious different personalities in life. And yes, there also will be some similar themes in their lives. Maybe they look similar, or maybe like both of them might have, you know, certain social similarities, maybe shy, not easy to make friends. And maybe that could be something that's genetic, because that's something that they both have experienced, even though they're completely in different worlds. So yes, there can be these similar themes, but there's also these differences. And I guess what I think is important to keep in mind with this science is to understand that it's not black and white. It's a complex combination. Like, life is not black and white. It's nuanced, and there's both forces at play, really, and they're working in some cases together to create who you are and your identity.
One of the, I don't know if you knew that the topic of adoption, you know, when you started this was going to be so, I don't know, I would say complicated or complex, that that would, did you have any idea when you started that that would be such an important issue in the book?
I did not know, I really did not know much about adoption. And so I came into this starting with the twins. And, but as a journalist, just like I'm a journalist who doesn't necessarily know a lot about epigenetics, I just, you know, hit the books, talk to the researchers and the experts. And with, as with twin science, there's years of research and data and many, many scientists who study this. With adoption, it's the same. There's decades of research that is out there for people to read. Many people who are studying adoption, many adoptees, and that was important to me to talk to adoptees, because historically, a lot of the research even has been led by, or the research and a lot of the even literature or stories that we hear about adoption might be told from the adoptive parents' perspective, or people being studied, the voices that come through are the adoptive parents. That's some of the historical research around adoption. So I wanted to speak to people who were adoptees doing research, or who were adoptees who are centered in some of the research, or who, you know, their voices are part of the studies, or who are writing their own novels, hosting their own podcasts, doing, you know, the work out there, or also historians and psychologists. And so I did that, and I learned a lot about adoption and the whole reality of adoption as a system, the history of adoption transnationally, transracially, going to Vietnam. Obviously, I talk a lot about that history in the book, but also just in our country, dating back to, you know, adoption transnationally, inter-country adoption, which, you know, a lot of this started after World War II, so I learned about this as well, and some of the challenges, and that became important to the book for me to have as some of the context for people. So yes, this is a story about twins who are separated and reunited, but it's also a story that involves adoption in major ways. You know, this is why their lives turned out the way they did, and so to not to sort of ignore the issue of adoption or the history or what all the researchers say would have given just one side of a story that's actually much more complex, just like with genes and the environment are also, it's nuanced and complex and it's not black or white. And that was what I hope to do with that research. So I did learn a lot.
Well, my last guest last week was a woman who had been adopted. And she said, and I don't know if you've ever looked at this part of it, she said that because she was curious about her birth mother.
Yeah.
And she did end up meeting her, but she had read, I think before she met her or before her mother gave her enough information to find her, she had read a book about the people who had given up the babies, like the She was saying the cheerleader and the football player who, you know, the girl got pregnant and then what happened to their lives.
Yeah.
Having given up the babies. And
sure.
She said, now, again, I just know what she said. I didn't read the book. Sure. I don't remember the book, but she said that their lives didn't turn out well, that it, and I don't know if that's what ruined it, but they never kind of recovered. So that's another thing to look at, which is the effect on those people.
Oh, absolutely. You know. Effect on the birth parents. There has been research, actually. There is a lot of research out there on who are the birth mothers, you know, and their lives as well. I mean, that's another area that you don't hear about, I guess.
Right.
Like, if the dominant narrative about adoption comes from adoptive parents, because maybe they all have the access to write, you know, be able to write their own story, to write the stories of their families, or be involved in research, right?
Yeah.
Hear these stories. a lot, but then the stories you hear less of throughout history has been adoptees themselves. Many were children, so they weren't, now they're grown up. So you can easily hear them on social media talking and literature and whatnot. But then the adoptive parents, which many, you know, might not have resources, might not have access to just the media or a research study.
You mean the birth? You mean the birth parents. Yeah, yeah.
That's what I meant to say. Yeah. Parents, the ones who, you know, obviously if they had a child that ended up being adopted, there's a reason, you know, they're struggling in some way. And so being part of a research study or writing their own life story into a memoir is not necessarily front and center on their head.
Right.
So you don't get to hear those stories, but there is research out there that's doing more of that work, especially around Korea. I know that there's been research into birth mothers in South Korea, for example. A lot of that led by adoptees as well, and different movements to, you know, to help the mothers and, for example, in Korea or, you know, so there's work around that, but that's a really valid point.
Yeah. I mean, and what this woman was saying was, you know, she had, even though she was adopted and she loved her family and she was grateful, she never really felt like she belonged or was actually loved, even though she probably was, until she met her birth mother and she learned why, you know, why she gave her up and why, you know, that it was like it filled in a hole for her. And I think, you know, if you're adopted, you must always wonder why, you know, you think it's your fault or something. I mean, I don't know if you found that, but you know, what was wrong with me that they gave me up, even, you know, even though it doesn't make sense, it had nothing to do with you, probably could have been any child, but you know, that would kind of complete it for people. I would think. And I would bet not everyone has that chance, you know, to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, when you talk to adoptees, everybody has a different experience and story and relationship to their own adoption. And one is not the same as the other necessarily. And certainly in the book I did hear, you know, the book that I wrote, The Twin in Vietnam, for example, talked about that feeling of, you know, especially even being bullied for her parents not wanting her. Why did they not want her? Mm-hmm. Kind of wondering that as well. But one thing I can say is that both of the twins on both sides of the world did experience, you know, families that really loved them deeply and did everything that they could to care for them. But there is that narrative in the US, for example, of being grateful that I talked to a lot of adoptees about this. Like, if you at all express, you know, interest sometimes in your birth family or sadness or a feeling of loss, which there's a lot of research around the loss and the trauma of adoption. Mm-hmm. Even if you've had a beautiful life and a happy life, you might have these feelings, right? That don't always match up with the narrative of the fairy tale adoption that we sort of hear about in the media and in stories.
Annie.
Yeah, there's a whole world of books and movies around the fairy tale adoption story. Yeah. And that can be really confusing if you aren't allowed to kind of have both of those feelings at once in your reality, and also the feeling of being grateful, but also feeling like, you know, that it's okay that I've had pain too. And, you know, I have both of these at the same time. And so I think that is something I learned a lot about, the complicated, kind of sometimes even contradictory emotions that happen within a person who's adopted, and these experiences that can also feel contradictory. You have this wonderful life, maybe with your family, but yet you have these questions about your past and who you are, whether it's your genes or your identity or why people made the choices that they made, or maybe you have challenges with your racial identity if you're transracially adopted, you know, and you're kind of trying to figure out, well, I know my family loves me, but I also know that I'm very different and the world sees me differently. And how do I reconcile that in my life?
Mm.
There's a lot. And then reunion is also complicated and involves a lot of people. And that's something I learned about as well. So it's one thing to see the reunion on TV and everybody, you know, has found the other half, as you would think that's what it is. But when you reunite, and in the case in this book, for example, that brought in then birth mothers, grandmothers, you know, siblings that you never knew of, all these other people who have their own trauma and sadness or experiences with this adoption that everybody's sharing a part of, you know, in a different way. They all have their own emotions around it. And that is complicated and can be painful to engage with, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So the other sister, the non-twin, you know, that's what stuck out for me was, you know, her birth family. And again, it wasn't the twins, but her birth family was reaching out and she was like, she couldn't deal with it. Leave me alone. I mean, that's just, I don't know if she felt bad about that. Like, I felt bad for the birth family that she didn't want to have anything to do with them. And I think later on, she maybe as she got more mature, she did. But that just that one scene, I was like, you know, they were crying and she was like, get away from me. But I mean, it's, I guess it's any teenagers too, you know.
But, I mean, that is also, again, like I said, everybody has a different experience and has different feelings around it. And, you know, she felt like, and you can understand it if you, I think, I could understand it if I put myself in her shoes. Like,
yeah. I'm not saying I didn't.
I know it was complicated because I wrote it.
yeah. It had to be hard for her. You know, you want to, but you don't. And how do you protect yourself? Yeah, just so much complication. You know.
Yeah, you're young. You have your life. And the way she put it to me is she didn't need another family. She didn't, you know, she had her life.
Yeah.
There wasn't room in her life at that point to have a whole different life, you know?
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's her feeling. And I respect that absolutely because, again, some people might spend their whole life searching and never find, there are adoptees in the book. They're not in this family, but different adoptees who are, for example, adopted after the war in Vietnam and put onto planes and sent to America as orphans who would be adopted. But a lot of the paperwork was lost. Some of them were not orphans. And many of them have never met their families, even though they've spent their lives searching because there's no record, there's no paperwork, there's no DNA test. And that's a hole that they have in their lives, right? But other people might not want to do that. Because they don't want to go down that route. So that's going to be different for everybody. So you do have that variety of experience kind of represented in the book. Also just to show that it's not one kind of experience, like a different interpretation and feeling about how complicated and hard some of these discussions about adoption can be.
Yeah. Well, I think you did an amazing job. How long did it take you to do all that research and the traveling? And then I have, wait, before you answer that, the mother of Isabella, the adopted mother, she was so determined to find, I don't know how you say, to get her to America. And I was wondering, it seemed from what you wrote, obviously you wrote the book, but that the aunt and the partner, you know, it's like, you know, you're taking away my child. Like who, I was kind of like, who the hell are you to be taking away the child? Even though, I mean, obviously there was more opportunity and stuff like that. And she did end up going, I think. What anything about that for you, or, you know, you can't probably give your opinion.
Well, I mean, I think that my opinion was that I think it's a complicated, it's just as complicated as you read it. And you're going to have, the reality is you're going to have all the mixed emotions. And I had them all. writing. And that's clear in how I think, even if I don't come in to parts and say my opinion, like what I've written, in a way you can see through that because it's like I'm putting it in there, and that's my choice to put it in there. That, yeah, the mothers in Vietnam were heartbroken when their daughter left to reunite with her twin and move to America. At the same time, she was coming for opportunities, and like, oh, many of us have lived lives and experienced that too, right? And the reality of immigration to America is that there's this one narrative of American dream that is and opportunity and education and success, but there's also loss because you leave behind culture, family, roots. And certainly that's the story of my father. You know, he came for opportunity, and then, but yet his mother and his family was still and is still in Japan. And, you know, when his mother passed away, my grandmother, he was not there. You know, he was in America living his life. That's the reality of the experience of immigration. And so they're feelings of pain, and they're mixed up with feelings of like opportunity and also like creating a whole new family in the US and joy there. And so I wanted those sections to be representative of the truth and all of its complexity. And you might have these feelings of like, well, who are you?
Right.
But also understand that at one point the twin in Vietnam decided up for herself that she to the U.S. So
And that could be any child of college age going to the U.S. So it's you're
going
right.
to college when you leave your kid goes to college across the country. You know, that's you know, have these emotions and of loss as a parent, but that doesn't mean that that you shouldn't also feel like that. I think what is true in these sections and as I write it is that I am acknowledging the kind of privilege that like Westerners and have, for example, to come in and kind of make decisions on behalf of other countries, which is sort of what has happened with adoption in the U.S. You know, like I mentioned, the Vietnamese children who came after the war, the U.S. government decided to send planes and bring children to America, thinking that that was the better life. But as he grew up, when he had struggles. And so it's the sort of assumptions that are made throughout the history of like adoption, for example, and also by the West to sort of dictate what is the better life. What is the better life for people who are in other countries or for people who come from countries that are war torn or have challenges with poverty, you know, and complicated, but it is something to kind of think about.
And thank you. This has been, we just have a couple minutes left, so I want to be able to, you know, complete it properly. I just want to thank you for, you know, for writing the book. I'll hold it up again somewhere, sisters. You just did an amazing job, you know, pointing out these issues. And I guess there's no clear cut answers, which just is really, you know, it's fascinating and gives you food for thought about all the different ramifications of all of it, you know, so thank you for doing that. Anything you would like to say in closing?
No, thank you. This is a great interview. I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm traveling, so I'm in an Airbnb right now.
Oh my God.
Not my fabulous home in the back. I'm glad that you were able to talk to me and do this conversation and get at a lot of the different issues raised in the book and in my work, which, as you can see, it's complicated in some ways. It's sometimes hard stuff, but I appreciate it. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. And what would you, is there anything you would want from the listeners to reach out or know, just read your stuff? Like, how do they find out more about you?
I have a website. It's erikahayasaki.com. So it's just my name, E-R-I-K-A, Hayasaki, H-A-Y-A-S-A-K-I.com. And you can email me on there. I've heard from readers of the book, and that's really nice when people send me messages. Also, all of the different stories that I worked on before the book and my links to the previous book, stories that we talked about earlier around dementia or identity,
Okay, great.
Those are on the website as well, and some writing resources for people who are interested in writing.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. And again, I want to thank KokoriApp.com for being our sponsor. If you want to learn more about social emotional learning, please go to KokoriApp.com. And they're a wonderful resource for your corporate team building and school social emotional learning fun. So thank you. Thank you again, Erica. And that's a wrap.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for sending me the book. I loved it.
Oh, thank you for having me. Sorry I was late.
Oh, that's okay. It happens, as they say.
Thank you for listening to the Getting Real with Hillary show. We hope you're entertained and inspired. Please subscribe to Hillary's newsletter. Go to gettingrealwithhillary.com for more freedom techniques and fantastic stories and links to other great stuff. And don't forget to tune in every week on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on BBS Radio TV. And let's get real. Let's get connected. Let's get inspired and create that life you love.